you very much.
Delighted to be here. I've only been here 3 hours and it's been completely marvellous already. Just to kind of maybe say briefly my relationship to words, my relationship to experience. I began trying to write poetry in my teens, as many people do, and was part of that generation with Paul Durkin and Mike Darwood's and so on, people who sat at the feet of Paddy Kavanagh and Chris Hutchinson and John Jordan and so forth, and McDade's in Dublin in the mid-late 60s. Was making some headway and then just totally burnt out and stopped writing for 20 years. Explored meditation and things of that nature, wanting then to return to the simplest forms of experience and expression. And then I rediscovered haiku and began writing haiku, and then slowly developed into writing in other forms, Western forms, and in latter years became interested in a form of prose based on direct experience, which combines prose writing traditionally, sort of travel journals and haiku. Some of you may have heard of Basho, who is probably the most famous haiku writer historically from Japan. But interestingly, when Basho was the person who created haiku as a kind of standalone form, but the traditional forms he was working with were forms of linked verse, where haiku were part of a linked sequence of verses, played as a party game very often, but also could be raised to a very high form of renku, linked verse. And also his travel journals, the most famous of which is The Narrow Road to the Deep North, in which he told of his pilgrimage, basically, both to spiritual and literary places that were a lot of power meaning for him, and he would tell of his travels and intersperse the travel notes with haiku. So that was how I came to haibun, which is the what I'm calling the prose form of haiku. And in a way, they're stories, stuff that you come on or experiences you have. Could be when you're wandering around the city or across continents or whatever. So this collection, The Fragrance of Dust, contains examples of those three forms. And in a way, the title sort of encapsulates my particular poetic project in that it is about discovering or uncovering beauty, significance, meaning in the least of things. That seems to me to be of interest. The least of things, the most insignificant of things. And in a way, haiku is also about that. It really is a poetry about very insignificant things. And to make poetry out of that is, of course, a bit of a challenge. And one of the great Zen teachers, great fool, Ryokan, said once, renowned as a very great poet in Japan, said, "Poetry? My poetry is not poetry. When you understand that, then we can talk about poetry." But it's about really the transformation of our everyday experience into poetry, which is maybe what poetry and all the arts are about anyway. So, having said all that, I'd like to begin with two very traditionally structured poems. one going back to my earliest inspiration in that period of the mid-60s, with a very dear friend of mine, and friend of over 60 years, so it's dedicated to him. And it's about youthful promise, adolescent aspiration, and Samuel Beckett's words come to mind, fail and fail better, the burning out of that youthful possibility. It's also, in some sense, a parody on Yeats's famous poem, The Municipal Gallery Revisited, because Billy and I used to hang out in the Municipal Gallery in Dublin, in Parnell Square, largely on Sunday mornings to get away from going to Mass, which was still mandatory in those days. And so it's called Portrait of an Ox and a Unicorn. For B. Half a life ago, when youth burned blue as a cutter's tool, two inseparable companions rattled the cage of every rule, trod the edge to vertigo. We woke to strangeness out of season, knew no antecedents, oddity our grudging alias, indifference our shaky alibi. Gallery visits, smuggled books sustained us, and the nighttime tracery of vision. Luminous wakings flashed, ideas sudden as rockets, images fragmentary and precious, intoxicant, dangerous. Hubris mounted on the red rush. We stole no sacred fires. All or nothing became nothing. On crept the slow chill of years. Now strike a light and see them drawn in a painted cave, your ox, my unicorn. Funnily enough, staying with Parnell Square, I don't know if you know Parnell Square, but the Municipal Gallery, the Hugh Lane Gallery, is on the north side, and on the south side there is a pub called Conway's, notorious for the passing of brown envelopes, because the City Council offices were just round the corner in O'Conn Street. Many a deal was done in Conway's, which is maybe why it's now closed and in the hands of Nama. But it was a wonderful old it was a wonderful old Dublin house, and mainly because it was just across the road from the Rotunda Hospital, the Rotunda Maternity Hospital, and many an expectant father would go in there and sit and wait. So in just such an expectant mood, I was wandering around Dublin. This would be now 25 years later, I guess, from the first point. In that hour of the day that photographers refer to as the golden hour, and I think that would have been a better title than the title I gave to it in the poem, you know, that hour of the afternoon, late afternoon, when the light is really kind of very, very golden, very rich, and there's a sense that, you know, you really, something is possible, just across the road from the rotunda. So, anyway, here's the poem. Into black the amber pours, the ripeness of an afternoon. The bald head gleams, an upraised glass sparkles into emptiness. Take out the pen. Its shadow creeps across the page, like a gnomon fingering a dial. Wait for it. Perhaps this time, voice the mute celestial. Fold the paper, put the pen away, hapless, unannunciate, the little thing too huge to say, mumble thanks and slink outside. On the corner, in the rain, the promise offers yet again. Smells of fruit and flowers float above the hawker's guttural shout. Buy a loaf and eat it on the way. So there are sort of two kind of, retrospectives, looking back. The next one I'd like to read is an example of this Haibun form, prose interspersed with haiku. It's called Between Bridges, and it's looking back at well, it's both contemporary, because I lived in the area later on in Sandymount by the sea there, but I used to bicycle around the area a lot. And some of you will remember the sweet, the Irish husband sweet sex, mm-hmm. Sweet tea. My mother in her latter years went to work there, and thousands of women worked in the sweet sex. It was one of the few kind of employments for older women of that generation, and they used to at some point my lessons go there and wait for her by the Dodder, which is the river that runs by there. So it's a combination of adult experience of living in the area and a reminiscence of going and waiting for her coming out of work. Between Bridges. The two bridges would be Lansdowne, the Lansdowne Bridge by Lansdowne Road, now the Aviva Stadium, and the one which is just off the river, Balls Bridge. So between those two bridges, there's a magical stretch of the river, Dodder. A Sunday morning in early July, after a night of warm rain, clouds promising more, the air cumescent with scents. At Lansdowne Bridge, on impulse, cycle upstream along the Dodder, and Dodra, the flood toward Balls Bridge. Brown waters in a green tunnel, here smooth, there breaking, melodious chatter of salt meeting sweet, low tide exposing bladder rack, where ducks doze and feed. At this hour, few up and about, local Sabbath keepers and some minders, of the moment. Voices low, three excited Japanese peer into the shadows. Under the railway arch, another world, fouled newspapers, odors of stale piss, transport smells, short pants, school toilets, bloom at stool above the rising. Buddleia, valerian, extravaganzas, pink and purple rooted in the stones, dusty fragrances. Waited for her here an age ago. The sweep. I'd stake my all on it. Bated breath. A nurse stands, starch stiff, holds aloft the winning ticket. Behold thy mother and her best friend May, leaning on the river wall, smoking sweet afton, day's work done. In mid-river, so close I stare into its unblinking eye, a heron stands, scratching its gullet with the long claw, black crest feathers erected in a fan, exercising its esophagus in long fish-swallowing gulps, bends its neck and hunches, watching the flow. A Sunday painter stands by his easel, brush poised, watercolors. Exchange nods, bids me good morning, Ulster accent. Down for a bit of peace and quiet, month that's in it, glorious 12th. with risking trespass, I remark, that's a sight worth seeing, and gesture to the harem. Looks better this way, I think. Composition. Gestures a diagonal to the poplars beyond. The bird is relegated to the lower corner. Select your realisms. A man leans on the parapet of Ball's Bridge, watching both of us, or so it seems. Drawing closer, I see that he is roughly dressed, nut brown, with a leathery face made darker by the shadow of his cap, foreign looking, seaman like. Loquacious now, I venture, worth watching, eh? He stares back at me, inscrutable. I wonder, has he English? Somewhere beyond words, he turns and resumes his watch. Absorbed, he is with the heron on the turning tide. So I thought some haiku now, if I may. And there is traditionally always a seasonal reference in haiku. So I look for, well, summer and heat. There was some conversation earlier. We say to people haiku, the first thing they think of is 575, right? Anybody here tried to write haiku? And do you think that 575 is the really important thing? Well, there's a lot of debate about that. And most people really understand, both about the Japanese and about Western practice, would say, well, no, no. It's not the vital thing. Anyway, there's a whole argument and debate around that. Quite a few of mine would be 575, but I wouldn't at all consider myself restricted by that. So anyway, you can bear that in mind yourselves. So here's two which have a, well, half a dozen or so here. Bear with me, which have a summer or heat reference. August heat. Faint click of pine cones. Opening as we part. There's a thing that somebody about said. When we read a haiku, because it's kind of over so quickly, people often ask, would it be read a second time?
Yes.
You want that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
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 When Maeve O'Sullivan read haiku here,
yeah.
2 years ago,
yeah.
On the 28th of
yeah.
August,
yeah.
Tonight I
met
we discussed it afterwards and
yeah.
Bought a second reading because they sit on the page so well,
yeah.
But auditory
correct.
Is a different medium and it's nice to be able
yeah.
To
because you read it 4 or 5 times by then
what does the rest of the house
even
feel
if
about it?
You read it twice.
Many twicers, there'll be lots of choices.
You're the opposite command in Italian, continue.
Give it a go, it might be
fun. Alright. There's not that Okay, I think on balance, the waltzers seem to have it on balance.
You're just shy.
Anyway, it is supposed to be the poetry of one breath, one utterance. So, you know, smarten up your gear there.
Listen good.
Okay, but just as a concession, I'll read the first one twice. So, August heat, faint click of pine cones, opening as we part. This is the man who didn't want to start. Okay. Too bad. Okay. The news across rippling corn, shadows scythe.
Again?
Shh. Moving quickly on.
The opening of the cash register.
Yeah, okay. Still chirping as a hot day ends. Churchyard sparrows. Oh, quick! The sun! The fiery sun sets beneath the bean rose. Inhaling meadow sweet, a wood pigeon's two notes float upstream. One was from the English market. Mm-hmm. It was in Cork a few years ago. I read another hive one from that occasion, but this one. This is 575. Okay. Sweating. What?
This is the remedial
test. Okay, very good. Sweating as he sweeps the fishmonger's yellowed ice into the river. Okay, so they refused summer haiku. So we're doing good here. Okay, seeing as it's sunny time, we'll go to Spain. And my dear brother, Frank, my youngest brother, the baby of the family, who lives in just outside of Zaragoza. Anybody knows Zaragoza in Aragon? I've been there on several memorable visits, Frank. And on one such, we were driving around northern Aragon, and I just hadn't thought about this at all, really. I was a great George Orwell reader in my younger years, and of course I would have read his homage to Catalonia, his wonderful account of his time in Spain in the Civil War. And there we came on the George Orwell Heritage Trail up in the foothills around Alcubierre, which he wrote about prior to coming down into Barcelona, into the thick of the fighting. So it's called Ruta Orwell, the Orwell Route, the Orwell Heritage Trail. So it begins with a haiku, there's a couple of short, prosy paragraphs, and then there's special bits in the fox. So, beginning with the haiku, foxy stink in the ruined fortress, harried even here. In Homage to Catalonia, George Orwell writes of the time he spent in these parts with the Poole militia during the Spanish Civil War. A Admiring the pockets of wheat assiduously planted between rocky outcrops, I am reminded of his observation that in the land which centuries before had perfected the manufacture of steel, the farm implements he saw in use were wooden. A man of La Corte harrows his red field as snow falls. Alcubierre, spears of winter wheat break stony ground. A stand of bearded thistles guards the pass. The trenches and sandbagged redoubts are reconstructions, but the scouring wind and the sense of melancholy in these hills is real. Monegros, the heroic struggle against boredom and lice. And it's followed by four haiku of around that time and that visit. First one being directly related. Yeah, there's a place name mentioned in this, which is one of the ancient kingdoms of that area. Lost kingdoms in the dust of Ribagorza, a child's blue glove. Bending to it, the dropped knife, a slice of blue sky. Dinner al fresco, serenaded from the rooftop by a cricket. Too hot to sleep, my companion tonight, a moth in white fur. Cool breeze fanning the nape of my neck, a wasp's wings. So that's the Spanish bit. So I'd like to go back to Hyburn now, if I may, and Cork. Some years ago, one of the things that I did in my previous work for St. John of God's, working on the field of therapeutic horticulture, was that we would take annual respite holidays with the people we worked with. And this happened on, this arose out of one of those visits. We were staying here in the city, and one of the guys, his passion was go-karting, and he discovered that there was a go-kart track north of Cork. So he was mad keen to go there. None of the others wanted to. They took off to the amusement arcade, so I drove with him, and we went to his house. So it's called Yego Eye, which was somehow became, these people have amazing capacity for enjoying language. And I say these people that are described as being intellectually disabled, people with special needs and so on, their capacity for enjoyment of language, their play with language, can be really quite amazing. And they slip in and out of frames of reference and so forth. It's one of the great delights of having the privilege of working with them. And one of the expressions which was extremely popular on that trip was Yego Eye. Yego Eye. Yego Eye! Was the kind of catch call of that particular trip. So, this is called Yego Eye. The slow boy, gazing skyward, hears it first. I put down the map and listen with him, hearing nothing but trucks and cars roaring past. He stands quite still, looking at me. You're sure? Yeah, go away. Okay. A mile or so off the motorway, sure enough, we find it, hidden in the hills. Now the noise is deafening. Boy racers screech around the big circuit in souped-up roadsters. We watch for a while. Cows graze the hillsides undisturbed. Clouds in a blue sky sail out to sea. And then to the figure eight go-kart track. Around and round he goes at a sedate pace while I watch. Tiring of it, I go back to the van for a snooze, leaving the attendant to keep watch. Good? He nods. And we're several miles away when I notice he's holding his hand awkwardly, a nasty burn, blistering. He gazes stoically out of the window. I can get no explanation out of him. Afraid I won't take him again. The village pharmacist. Cool gel and a dressing. Painkillers. No, he won't take any payment. Healing hands, where the name itself is balm. Watergrass Hill. Drive on to the seaside. He loves the Marys. Yeah, go we. Three more minutes. Okay. We have a little special treat on the CD here. So, there are a couple of other poems I would like to offer you. One is called "To a Fallen Swallow," again in a traditional vein. Part of our work was, you know, we did very basic grounds maintenance work. So, do you know, like office parks? We would like sweep and clean up and take out the garbage and that kind of thing. So we were doing that kind of work one day, and I was doing the sweeping, which is the first line actually. Sweeping around the office park, I find the little clochard fallen from the eaves, its nest dissolved to mud and straw by winter rain. The yard brush stirs the feathered bones and halts. A light handful you make, slight you remains. Alive, you'd never let me hold you. Half ashamed, I gaze. Your red throat, sun swallower, amazes. And your bands of blue, but it's your pert beak, sky dart, pierces me. No cage ever closed around you, pilgrim. On my open palm, your inch width stretches without end. Your ounce outweighs the world. That's "To a Fallen Swallow." And the last poem to read was my awe upon visiting the Alwi Caves. Not a million miles from here. I was really odd, as they say nowadays, gobsmacked on visiting the old caves. And I have to say, this may sound self-righteous, a little pissed off, because there was a ferocious amount of chatter going on, crowds of people going through it and all the rest of it. Whereas I felt odd and wanted to basically worship. And I came back and I wrote this at the kitchen table in 10 minutes. At the Alwi Caves, this is my high priest told me. Tongue be still and mind quiet, clear as a stone pool. Heart swell, be ample as these caverns, full of listenings. Bring here a lifetime's roaring and say, enough. Here is the living core. Bow, head and stiff neck, as a bear, as a deer drinking. Bow to the kill and to the gorging, to the red on snow, to the melting and to the new green. Bow to the first coming of the upright ones. Bow to the last cindered star. Bow.